Hello, Bay Ridge. Welcome back to another special edition of After Hours. This is a series of audio After Hours, and they're also extended. We're taking time to walk through Mark chapter 13, either a section or even sometimes a verse at a time. And this is going to be the fourth in this series. We're going to be looking at Mark chapter 13, verses 24 to 26. I will say at the beginning of this one that some of this material is very, very similar to a teaching that was done on Mark's gospel on October the 6th of 2024. It's called the New Covenant Temple. I'm going to be covering some of the same material as was covered there, but going into a little bit more depth and kind of piecing things together a little bit differently. But there will be a lot of similarities. So in Mark chapter 13, verses 24 to 26, we see a lot about heavenly signs and the Son of Man and there being mourning on earth. And it appears to people that these can't have been fulfilled in 70 AD. But I want to go back and show that actually Jesus is referencing Old Testament texts throughout. And these Old Testament texts, in fact, were not looking for these kind of signs to be fulfilled literally, but were metaphorical examples of the day of the Lord and very, very important events in history. And these are actually referencing 70 AD. So let's begin by looking at verses 24 and 25. And Mark 13, 24 and 25, and this is in the NIV, the 1984 edition, says, "But in those days following that distress, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken." And as a young believer, when I looked at this, I said, well, obviously this must be talking about the end of the world, the final return of Jesus Christ. I mean, there's no way that the sun was darkened and the moon didn't give its light, and especially that stars fell and the whole heavens were shaken, referencing in 70 AD. There weren't those kind of heavenly disruptions. And I was following advice that I'd been given by others, which said, you know, when you read something like the Olivet Discourse or the Book of Revelation or these kind of apocalyptic or prophetic texts, do it with the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other. But I want to encourage you, that is horrible advice to follow. You do not read with the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other. You read with a passage like the Olivet Discourse in one hand and the Old Testament in the other. Because in these three verses we're going to be looking at today, Jesus is basically stitching together a bunch of Old Testament texts. And it's in reading the Old Testament text that we understand what he actually means. Now, the reason I say this is in verses 24 and 25, where we just read, if you notice, the NIV even puts quotes around, "The sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, the heavenly bodies will be shaken." It puts quotes around these because this is actually alluding back to two different passages in the book of Isaiah. First, it's an allusion to Isaiah chapter 13, specifically verses 9 and 10. But I'll read verse 1 as well just to give context and to show that actually this passage was not only fulfilled in 70 AD, it had already been fulfilled over 500 years before the time of Christ. In Isaiah 13, we read an oracle concerning Babylon that Isaiah, son of Amos, saw. And then it talks a lot about what's happening. And then in verse 9 and 10, we get to the phrases that Jesus is using. It says, "See, the day of the Lord is coming." Notice that phrase, "day of the Lord." We're going to come back to that. "A cruel day with wrath and fierce anger to make the land desolate and destroy the sinners within it. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light." And so scholars all recognize, and even the translators of English translations recognize, this is what Jesus is referring to. Jesus is alluding here to Isaiah 13:10 and also Isaiah 34:4, which we'll look at in a minute. But notice here in Isaiah 13, this passage is not only not about the end of the world, it's actually about the destruction of Babylon, which did happen in 539 BC. And we know specifically that's what's being referenced because in this very chapter, Isaiah tells us, the Lord tells us through Isaiah, that it's referencing when the Medes, the Medo-Persian Empire, came and destroyed Babylon. In verse 17, we read, "See, I will stir up against them the Medes, who do not care for silver and have no delight in gold. Babylon, the jewel of kingdoms, the glory of the Babylonians' pride, will be overthrown by God like Sodom and Gomorrah. So notice this text in Isaiah 13 that includes these heavenly signs that Jesus is quoting is not about the end of the world. It's about the fall of Babylon, which happened in 539 BC. It's fulfilled when the Medo-Persian Empire conquered Babylon. And there's no record anywhere that there were these heavenly disturbances or anything like that that happened when Babylon was conquered by the Medo-Persian Empire and ceased to be an empire for the rest of human history. And that's because Isaiah didn't intend that whatsoever. If anybody had gone to him and said, so you mean literally the stars are not going to show light, the sun is going to be darkened, the moon's not going to give light, he would have said, what on earth are you talking about? That is not the way they use the phrase. I've referenced before the same way if I say it's raining cats and dogs, I do not literally mean that Bengal tigers and German shepherds or basset hounds are falling out of the sky. It's a colloquialism. It's a phrase that is using metaphorical language to describe something. In that case, raining very hard. In this case, the point is not literal, quote unquote, heavenly signs, but it's going to be a world-shattering day of judgment. And so Isaiah had prophesied this in Isaiah chapter 13. There is no question. It was fulfilled in 539 BC, but it didn't include these literal things, that happened. There's no record of any of that because that's not the way apocalyptic language, especially surrounding the day of the Lord, is used. Jesus is also alluding in the last part of the quote to Isaiah 34, 4, where we read, all the stars of heaven will be dissolved and the sky will be rolled up like a scroll. All the starry hosts will fall like withered leaves from the vine, like shriveled figs from the fig tree. So notice here, it's saying that the stars of heaven are going to actually be dissolved and the whole sky is going to roll up. The starry hosts are going to fall. And Jesus is alluding to this when he says the heavenly bodies will be shaken, the stars will fall from the sky. He's alluding to Isaiah 34, 4. But this passage in Isaiah 34 is not about the end of the world. This passage is about the day of the Lord for Edom. When they helped to destroy Judah, God said that Edom itself was going to get destroyed. And this was fulfilled long before the time of Jesus. And once again, the stars did not literally fall from the sky. We can walk out tonight and see the stars in the heavens. There's no record of any such thing like that happened. The sky was not rolled up like a scroll in that day. That was not the intent of the language. It's apocalyptic imagery saying that the nation is going to be shattered. So both Isaiah 13 and Isaiah 34 that Jesus is quoting had been fulfilled long before Jesus requotes them and reuses them in the New Testament. And in their original setting, they had nothing to do with literal heavenly signs, but rather were apocalyptic imagery to show that the day of the Lord was going to be a day of severe judgment upon these people. And this is what's interesting. There's a constant stream in the Old Testament of text regarding what is known as the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is not one single day. It's a phrase that is used to reference a coming time of judgment upon a people where people will get judged. And sometimes God is delivering his people out of it. Sometimes the people of God themselves are the ones who are going to be judged. So for example, in Amos chapter 5, verses 18 to 20, we can read another very famous day of the Lord text. In Amos 5, beginning at verse 18, we read, woe to you who long for the day of the Lord. The people of Israel and the 10 tribes said they were looking for the day of the Lord because they thought it was going to be a day of deliverance. But Amos says, why are you longing for the day of the Lord? He says, why do you long for the day of the Lord? That day will be a day of darkness, not light. It will be as though a man fled from a lion only to meet a bear, as though he entered his house and rested his hand on the wall only to have a snake bite him. Will not the day of the Lord be darkness, not light, pitch dark, without a ray of brightness? So notice, very similar to the text in Isaiah 13 and in Isaiah 34, there's a reference that the heavenly bodies are not going to give their light. It's going to be a day of darkness. And this day of the Lord that Amos is talking about, a day where there's no sun, there's no moon, there's no stars, this day of the Lord is again not the end of the world. It's not the future. It's about the judgment that came on the northern 10 tribes, Samaria, in 722 BC, when Assyria came in and destroyed them. This text was fulfilled long, long ago. It's not something in our future. It's something that definitively we know came to pass when Israel was destroyed in 722. But that day of the Lord did not have literal heavenly signs, but rather they were a metaphor for the great judgment and destruction that was about to fall on the 10 tribes. Another place where we see this is in the book of Zephaniah. In Zephaniah chapter 1, verses 14 and 15, and then verse 18, we read, "The great day of the Lord is near, near and coming quickly. Listen, the cry on the day of the Lord will be bitter, the shouting of the warrior there. That day will be a day of wrath, a day of distress and anguish, a day of trouble and ruin, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and blackness." And then in verse 18, "In the fire of his jealousy, the whole world will be consumed, for he will make a sudden end of all who live in the earth." Now, Zephaniah prophesied during the reign of Josiah, not long before the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple and the exile to Babylon. But notice the same motif is being used here as in Amos and is also in those texts in Isaiah, that the day of the Lord is dark, it's gloomy, it's clouds, it's blackness, as opposed to a beautiful sunny day or a beautiful night with a moon and the stars. No, it's a day of complete darkness. And in fact, Zephaniah even says the whole world will be consumed. There's going to be a sudden end to everyone who lives on the earth. Now, we know not everyone on earth died. We know not the entire world was consumed, but we also know this text was actually truly fulfilled in the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple and the exile in 586 BC. So all of these are the day of the Lord that happened in the Old Testament, and we could multiply this with many other texts, but notice they all reference these kind of heavenly signs and it being a time of darkness, it being a time of catastrophe. Well, Jesus is using this metaphor to say that there is a coming day of the Lord for Israel. Remember, this whole thing is about the destruction of the temple. And Jesus is saying there's a day of the Lord coming. And many people are going to think it's a day of deliverance, but it will not be. It will be a day of judgment. So in verses 24 and 25, again, in those days following that distress, when the abomination that causes desolation, remember Luke tells us that is the Roman armies surrounding Jerusalem, and they're going to come in and destroy the temple. Following that distress, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, the heavenly bodies will be shaken. Jesus is saying, when you see that abomination of desolation, when you see the Roman armies coming, I told you to get out, because here's what's happening. The day of the Lord is about to strike, and it's going to be a day of judgment on Israel. So he's using the Old Testament language that was common for such pronouncements, and they're never literal in the sense of actually stars fall from the sky or the moon doesn't give light, because of course the moon doesn't even give light in the first place, or that the sun is struck dark. They are not quote unquote literal, which is really silly wooden literality. Rather, they are profoundly true. It means it's going to be a day of catastrophe. There is a world-shattering judgment that is coming. And Jesus says in this case, it's coming on apostate Israel. It's going to be a sign that the old covenant is being done away with, the temple is going to be destroyed, and the new covenant is going to be the way that God relates to humanity. Now, I talked about this in that teaching on the New Covenant Temple, and we'll come back to that in just a couple of moments. But I want to note there are some questions, because in verse 26, which I did not cover in that teaching, we read that the Son of Man is going to come in the clouds with great power and glory. Verse 26 in Mark says, "At that time men will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory." So many must look say, well, there's no record that anybody saw Jesus, and when Jesus comes back like that, it's the end of history. But this is not referring to the final return of Christ or the visible return of Christ, which is true, but it has nothing to do with this text. Once again, Jesus is alluding to an Old Testament text. In this case, Daniel 7, 13, and 14, which he had already alluded to in back to the book of Daniel in the abomination that causes desolation. Here, he's going back to Daniel's vision in chapter 7, where there's the four kingdoms, and in the time of the fourth kingdom, the God sets up an eternal kingdom. And in verses 13 and 14, we read, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man." Notice the son of man. "Coming with the clouds." Same thing he says in Mark chapter 13. "Coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power." So notice, Jesus said he's going to be coming in the clouds with great power and glory. Same words as are all there in Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. And notice there, he says, "All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshiped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." So Jesus is clearly referencing Daniel 7, 13 and 14 here. But notice Daniel's vision's not about the end of the world, but rather about the enthronement of the Son of Man. And notice that in Daniel, the Son of Man is riding the clouds, not down to earth at his final return, but rather up to the Ancient of Days to be enthroned with great power and glory. So the focus in Daniel, and also here in Jesus's words, is Jesus the Son of Man ascending to the Father's right hand to be enthroned as Lord of heaven and earth. What he's referencing is that there's going to be, during this time when all of this is happening, there is proof that Jesus the Son of Man is enthroned with great power and glory. And this is true in 70 AD, it's true today. It's been true ever since the ascension of Christ, which is the picture that is there in Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. And we know Jesus is referencing this, and this is what his meaning is, because he does the same thing in Mark chapter 14, verses 61 and 62. Jesus is before the high priest, he's being tried, and he makes this same point there to the high priest. In Mark 13, it's just privately to the four disciples. Here, he's making it to the high priest and to all those who are standing around at the trial. We read in Mark 14, 61 and 62, "Again, the high priest asked him, 'Are you the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?' 'I am,' said Jesus." So Jesus is now openly proclaiming that he is the Messiah. And then he links this with the Son of Man. He says, "And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." This is again an allusion back to Daniel 7, 13 and 14. Jesus says, "I am the Messiah. And as the Messiah, I am the Son of Man." And what that means is I'm going to be enthroned in heaven. I'm going to come with the clouds and power and glory, just like Daniel speaks of in Daniel 7, 13 and 14. So he's telling the people judging, rejecting, and putting him to death, "You're going to see the Son of Man coming in the clouds." Now notice, he doesn't say other people are going to see this thousands of years from now. He's saying, "You who are judging me are going to see me coming in the clouds. You're going to see that I am the fulfillment of Daniel 7, 13 and 14. And they did see this, both in the destruction of the temple and also in the coming of the Gentiles to worship Jesus. Notice in Daniel 7, 13 and 14, it says he sets up a kingdom and people from all nations are coming to worship him. So as those who rejected Jesus put him to death, then they are told that he has been raised from the dead. They cannot find their body. They lie about it. And then they watch the church, despite their persecutions, continue to thrive and actually to grow, and the Gentiles to begin to flock into the church. All of this is proof positive. Jesus says, "You now know I am the Messiah. I did come on the clouds of glory up to the Father in heaven. I am seated at his right hand, and I am now executing dominion over the world." And so they see it in all of those events, and then they also see it in the destruction of the temple. That when the temple is destroyed and it is the end of the old covenant, it is proof that the old covenant and its temple has been done away with and the new covenant has come. So this coming reference to the high priest is a coming in judgment on apostate Israel. It's a day of the Lord text. That's what Jesus was talking about. Not that everybody was visibly looking up and seeing him floating down on a cloud. Rather, it is a reference to the day of the Lord text. Now, people then sometimes say, but doesn't it say specifically that he will be seen? Notice in Mark 13, 26, "At that time, men will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great glory. So he's saying he's going to be seen. You may be saying, Brett, that he ascended to the right hand of the Father, but they have to literally see him. Well, first off, it does not mandate physical vision. That's very unusual. In fact, Jesus seated at the right hand of the Father was only literally seen this way by Stephen at the time of his martyrdom. You can see in Acts 7:50 to 56, and to Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus, we read about in Acts 9. But as far as we know, no one else has ever been given that privilege of actually physically seeing Jesus. But the text doesn't demand that everyone physically see him. What is referenced is seeing that he is actually enthroned in heaven. This is what Matthew refers to as the sign of the Son of Man. In Matthew 24:30, in the same saying, as he's translating it from the Aramaic to the Greek, and a little distinctly from the way Mark does, he says, at that time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. The NIV uses it. And the nations of the earth will mourn. They'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. So Matthew tells us what is seen or what appears is the sign of the Son of Man. Not they'll see the Son of Man himself. They're going to see the sign of the Son of Man. And it's actually, unfortunately, the NIV in the 1984 edition translates it that the sign will appear in the sky. But the word for sky is actually Urano, which is the word for heaven throughout this passage, and is commonly translated in the New Testament. For example, it's our Father who is in heaven, not our Father who's in the sky. It's the sky in the sense of heaven, and it's translated as heaven by the NIV in 2011, the King James, the ESV, the ASV. And so what Jesus is saying here is not that people are going to see him literally on the clouds just around earth, but they're going to observe the sign is that Jesus is who he claimed to be. He's the Son of Man. He's been vindicated by God through the resurrection, the ascension, and he is now seated at the Father's right hand. And this sign is furthermore seen in a final sense and shown openly to everyone when what Jesus predicted, the Roman army surrounding Jerusalem, and then the coming and the conquering of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. What Jesus had said about that here in Mark 13, Matthew 24, and Luke 21 has in fact happened. Jesus spoke it prophetically. It did come to pass, and that was seen by all of them. And I point out that this is all in line with these Day of the Lord texts in the Old Testament. It's also in line with all of the cloud rider, they're often referred to text. Text where when God comes on the clouds, which is a very common phrase in the Old Testament, we see that he rides on the clouds, but he's never seen physically with our eyes. So for example, in Psalm 68:4, we read, sing to God, sing praise to his name, extol him who rides on the clouds. God is the cloud rider. Yahweh is the cloud rider. His name is the Lord, it goes on. And so we should rejoice before him. Again, the psalmist is not saying that everybody observed Yahweh riding on the clouds. They're just saying he's the one who does ride on the clouds. This is a figure for his presence and especially his judgment. In Psalm 104, we read, he makes the clouds his chariots and rides on the wings of the wind. So notice God is the clouds are his chariot. He's a chariot rider. He's a warrior. It's a picture of this. And this phrase is used a lot of different times. This imagery is used many times in the Old Testament. And it's used a lot to describe God coming in judgment of someone or to deliver his people from those who are persecuting him. So for example, in Isaiah 19:1, we read an oracle concerning Egypt. See, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and is coming to Egypt. Again, he's the cloud rider, but there's no clue in Isaiah 19, and we know nothing from history, that people in Egypt literally saw Yahweh riding on a cloud. In fact, we're told no one's ever seen God, but yet we're told, see, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and is coming to Egypt. So the language is very similar to what Jesus is using here, because this is what he is alluding to. Jesus is the cloud rider. He is God himself coming to execute judgment, just as he did on Egypt in the Old Testament, an apostate nation, but also as he did to deliver his people. In Psalm 18, the psalmist is writing, And he's talking about God riding in to deliver him. And he says in Psalm 18, verses 7 to 11, the earth trembled and quaked. The foundations of the mountain shook. They trembled because he was angry. Smoke rose from his nostrils. Consuming fire came from his mouth. Burning coals blazed out of it. He parted the heavens and came down. Dark clouds were under his feet. He mounted the cherubim and flew. He soared on the wings of the wind. He made the darkness his covering, his canopy around him, the dark rain clouds of the sky. Out of the brightness of his presence, clouds advance. So notice here that in this, God is again the cloud rider. He's parting the heavens. He's coming down. And there's these all these references to clouds around him. And often the clouds are dark clouds that he's doing, because he's pictured like a chariot rider riding into battle. Now, again, none of this is literally. God did not literally have smoke in his nostrils. I think we can all recognize that. Nor did he literally ride on the clouds. It is powerful, poetic, figurative, metaphorical language to speak of God coming as a warrior to judge the enemies of his people. And it's the same kind of language Jesus used in Mark 13. If one wants to claim this has to be literally fulfilled in Mark 13, then one must say it also was in Psalm 18 and Isaiah 19 and Isaiah 13 and Isaiah 34 and Zephaniah. And we know in all those places it was not fulfilled in that way. And it's silly to then say, but it has to be in Mark chapter 13. That doesn't line up with how the phrase is used throughout Scripture. Now, one last thing that I'll talk about today that I've not discussed before is, what about in Matthew? It specifically says, yes, but when this happens, all the nations of the earth will mourn. And people say this is at the end of time when Jesus comes back and the rebellious nations are being judged. But it's actually not. It's again about Israel in the land. And we might suspect this by the fact that, again, the entire section is about the destruction of the temple. And Jesus said it's all going to happen during that generation. But notice here, when we read in Mark 24:30, that the Son of the Man will appear in the sky and all the nations of the earth will mourn. They'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. We've discussed all of it except for the nations of the earth will mourn. So how is this something that was fulfilled in 70 AD? Well, the first thing I would note is the word for nations here is the Greek word phulai. And the word phulai is normally, in fact, virtually universally translated as tribes. In fact, that's how it is translated in the King James, the ESV, and the ASV, the American Standard Version. And the word phulai is used 23 times in the New Testament. And with the exception of Matthew 24:30 and Revelation chapter 1, verse 7, which is referencing the same saying of Jesus, it is always, every last time, translated tribe rather than nation. In fact, virtually every time it specifically speaks of the tribes of Israel. So you can look at Matthew 19:28, Luke 2:36, Luke 22:30, Revelation 21:12 are some examples where it specifically is the tribes of Israel. That is overwhelmingly how the word is normally used. In fact, Matthew only uses the word one other time. He only uses phulai one other time, and that's in Matthew 28, which specifically says that the 12 apostles are going to be sitting on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So we can see that's normally how it's used. Furthermore, the term phulai, this word, is used in a list with laos, which is a word that means people, and or ethnos, from which we get our word ethnic or ethnicity, which is a word that is usually translated as nation. And these are the terms that are usually used to describe the Gentiles and their nations. And you can see in Revelation 7:9, Revelation 11:9, Revelation 13:7, Revelation 14:6, all of these have lists where it's talking about all the tribes and languages and tongues and nations of the earth. And the tribes seems to refer specifically to Israel, and the nations as being the rest of the Gentile nations. So the strong preference here should be that the word should be all the tribes are going to mourn. And also it's interesting that the word for earth is geis, which can either be used to reference the entire world or specifically the land of Israel. It can also be used even to refer to the ground, the dirt, as opposed to the sea, but that's kind of irrelevant for here. So the only way to know, do we mean the entire planet or specifically that specific land or nation, usually the promised land, Israel, is you have to look at the context. So if you look the first four times that Matthew uses this word gaze, they all clearly refer to the land of Israel, not the earth or the world. You can look in Matthew 2:6, Matthew 2:20, Matthew 2:21, and Matthew 4:15. All of them are clearly referencing the land of Israel. That's what's there. So in those cases, it's the first four times Matthew uses the word, gaze clearly means just the land. However, there are times that Matthew uses gaze to refer to the whole earth, the whole planet, such as in Matthew 5:18 and Matthew 16, Matthew 6, verse 10. That's in the Lord's Prayer, that God's will would be done on earth as it is in heaven. There, it's not just the land of Israel. It's clearly the whole planet. And in Matthew 5:18, Jesus says that heaven and earth might pass away, not just the land of Israel, but the whole earth. So the question has to be clearly decided by the context. And here, given that it's clear that the tribes of Israel are in view, I think that it would really be a good translation policy to say land is probably a better translation than earth. So really what you're probably looking at is all the tribes of the land will mourn. And it's certainly what happened when the temple was being destroyed. But I would even point out that even if you translate it as all the tribes of the earth, it is true that when the sign that Jesus was truly the exalted enthroned Son of Man, who was executing judgment upon apostate Israel and using the Roman army to destroy the temple, the tribes of Israel, whether those who were in the land of Israel or those who were living in Rome or Alexandria or wherever they were, when they heard what happened to the temple and they heard what happened to Jerusalem, they mourned. That mourning went on for a long time. It became part of the liturgy, actually, of doing it. So the tribes of the land, the tribes of the earth, did in fact mourn. So all of this means, when we look at it, that actually Mark 13:24-26, and that's also Matthew 24:29-30, are not talking about the end of the world. They're talking about the destruction of the temple and the end of the old covenant era. And I want to remind us again, as we're looking at this and we look at these phrases, you may say, well, you got to talk about a lot of different things. But it's very clear the context is that first, it's about the destruction of the temple. It's not about the end of the world. Mark 13:1-4, where they're leaving the temple and the disciples say, look at this amazing temple. And Jesus says in verse 2, do you see all these great buildings? Not one stone here will be left upon another. Everyone will be thrown down. It's about that temple getting destroyed. And the question that the disciples ask is, when will these things happen? When's the temple going to be destroyed? And what will be the sign that they're all about to be fulfilled? There's nothing in Jesus' statement or in the question of the disciples regarding the end of the world. It's all about the destruction of the temple. So we would already suspect that it's all referencing that which happened in 70 AD. But furthermore, I remind us, Jesus clearly promised that everything in Mark 13:1-29, every last thing that's discussed there, will be fulfilled during this generation. I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. So clearly, everything that we've been discussing had to happen during that generation. That's by Jesus's clear words. And there's nothing metaphorical about those words. Unlike stars falling out of the sky and those kinds of things, those are very clear, straightforward words. So we have to interpret everything in light of them. And what this tells us is, it's actually clear, if you're familiar with your Old Testament and you're reading the Old Testament along with this, this is a day of the Lord text. It's the day of the Lord against apostate Israel. And Jesus is quoting from the day of the Lord text in the Old Testament. So the imagery is not about literal heavenly signs, because it never was that way in any of the day of the Lord text in the Old Testament. But it's using the common images and motifs of the day of the Lord text to indicate impending disaster. It is the day that Jesus as the divine warrior would ride upon the clouds to judge the enemies who were persecuting his people, the church. I remind you, as we read over and over and over again in the book of Acts, these very people that Jesus was coming and judging were persecuting and killing Christians for proclaiming and believing that Jesus was the Messiah. So this coming on the clouds never indicated a visible coming in the Old Testament, and it does not indicate that here in Mark chapter 13. Rather, it's Jesus making claim to be deity, that he himself is actually the cloud rider. And so the destruction of the temple and the end of the Old Covenant era is a world-shattering event. Everything changes, and thus the apocalyptic language is appropriate. But I'll close in these last seconds reminding us, though this was a terrible time for those Jews who stubbornly refused to embrace Jesus and who chose to kill God's Son and continue rejecting him and persecuting his people, it's actually better in the end for everyone. And that includes Jews and Gentiles. For the end of the Old Covenant means the New Covenant is fully in effect, and it is a far superior covenant. It is better news for both Jews and Gentiles, for everyone. And so as we're going through this text, which is about judgment, we always have to remember that in the end, mercy triumphs over judgment because the New Covenant has come, and that is good news for everyone. Hope this is helpful, and you can tune in another session where we're going to be looking at verse 27 and questions about the angels gathering the elect. Have a great day. God bless.